Welcome to Dementia Resilience with Jill Lorenz, a candid conversation as we learn about types of dementias, such as Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, frontal temporal, and Lewy body, and the effects on the people we love. Jill's years of dedication and experience help you adapt, overcome obstacles, and find positive outcomes. It's time for Dementia Resilience with Jill Lorenz.
Welcome back, friends. I am really pleased that today I have a guest in studio with me, and I think you're really going to enjoy this conversation. I want to introduce Dr. Zachary Mackey, and he is a neurologist working in the UCH Health, well, the University of Colorado Health Memory Disorders Clinic, and primarily works with patients living with neurodegenerative conditions like Alzheimer's disease and other forms of dementia. And he attended the medical school at the University of Kansas and completed his clinical training at the University of Colorado. Currently, he is a research fellow in the CU Palliative Care and Aging Research Training Program, with much of his work focused on ways to integrate palliative care into routine neurological care, including ways to improve advances in care planning for early stage Alzheimer's disease and improve caregiver support and symptom management. Right up my alley. Couldn't be happier to have you today, Zach. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you very much for having me today.
Well, welcome to the team of Dr. Holden and Company.
Yes.
Samantha has been a regular guest on the show, and she has helped our listeners nationwide and worldwide to understand about Alzheimer's and other memory disorders, other dementias in that realm. And I bet she's absolutely pleased to have you on her team. So welcome, welcome, welcome.
Yeah, of course.
So you came to Denver in 2015, and what have you been doing at UC Health since then?
Yeah, so 2015, I came out here to do my clinical training. I did a year of medicine and then 4 years of neurology, as one would do during a neurology residency program. And then following that, this past academic year, so not currently, but completed this in June, I had the opportunity to do a fellowship in behavioral neurology and neuropsychiatry. And actually, Dr. Holden was one of my supervising physicians during that period of time, amongst other folks and faculty in that group in the memory disorders clinic. So I got really good hands-on experience taking care of patients with Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's, really anything that involves cognition or behavior, sort of managing those issues as they arise, and also supporting their caregivers. And then completed that in June, and now I've sort of transitioned away from the clinical side of things into more dedicated research training, which is not something that normally one would get during their clinical training, the experience to actually do research. Mm-hmm. And so over the next couple of years, I'm going to be a part of the, as you mentioned, Palliative Care and Aging Research Fellowship through CU. And, you know, I've been trying to develop and get off the ground a number of projects and ways that we can look into incorporating palliative care into the way we take care of these patients and support their caregivers. And it's been a strong interest of mine going back to the early days of my residency, palliative care and its way and its application to dementia care and taking care of patients who have progressive neurological conditions.
Well, I love that. And I have worked over the past 4 years with some of the doctors that you're probably working with. First, Benzie Kluger, who is big proponent of palliative care and ways that we can look at it in a different light. And, of course, Christina Vaughn. And Peter Pressman, and so on and so forth. So just to give the listeners a clear picture, explain what palliative care is.
Right. So the easiest way to describe palliative care is that it's medicine that's really focused on quality of life, looking at all aspects of a patient's life, not just their disease necessarily, but things that extend beyond their disease, including the way it affects their caregivers, the way it affects them emotionally, how they cope and deal with their illness as it progresses and gets worse in some circumstances. Traditionally, it was and historically viewed as, you know, medicine that focuses on sort of the end of life and making people feel comfortable. But really, that's just a piece of palliative care. That's only a component that that palliative care does address. But knowing that, you know, someone who isn't necessarily in the end of life can still get palliative care, medicine that is directed at making sure they are experiencing life to the fullest and that their quality of life is the best that it could possibly be. And within that, we have neuropalliative care, which is really this sort of new emerging field within palliative medicine that really is focused on patients suffering with from neurological conditions. And so that's really where, as you mentioned, Dr. Benzie Kluger, has been, you know, sort of a pivotal player in getting neuropalliative care research off the ground and expanding our knowledge of how we can use palliative medicine. And it's becoming a bigger and bigger thing as you look to some of these organizations that focus on neurology and taking care of patients with neurological conditions.
So would that include, for example, not just our friends with a diagnosis of Alzheimer's, but also Parkinson's disease, maybe posterior cortical atrophy?
Absolutely.
Frontotemporal and so on and so forth? Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. Because these conditions are so complex in the way that they manifest and the symptoms that are experienced and then how those symptoms interfere with day-to-day life. So palliative care really addresses sort of the complexity of these conditions, knowing that there are so many factors that we can work on and treat to improve their quality of life, for sure. Those conditions would definitely be applicable to this approach.
That's excellent. And just to give you a little background, I 4 years ago was invited by Benzie, Dr. Kluger, to come and meet his team. So it was Ryan Kahn and Carrie Friedman and so on and so forth, his nurse and everybody that is on his team, Julie Burke. A very big component of that team. And I started teaching classes for them to caregivers. And so and I've been doing that now for 4 years. I'm still doing it. And over the last year, I've also been doing it now on the Alzheimer's and Lewy body side for Samantha and her whole team. And so every month I have a class for the Memories Disorders Clinic. And so I teach caregivers how to live resiliently with these diseases and the symptoms and how to manage their own emotions and so on and so forth so we can get the best for everyone, the best quality of life, the maintaining of the dignity and so on and so forth. And for the Parkinson's group, I do it every quarter. And I was so honored to be brought into the team to be able to work on that side of it. So I am excited to hear what you think is going to be the new frontier for neuropalliative care.
Yeah. I think, this is something that certainly Dr. Kluger has been pivotal and pushing forward, but looking at ways that we can sort of integrate palliative care into sort of the standard care that a patient might receive. So, for example, I mean, a palliative care approach is something that you don't have to be a specialized palliative care expert to do. But of course, it requires, you know, the right sort of support in whatever practice you're doing. That could be a primary care physician, that could be a general neurologist, could be a behavioral neurologist like myself. So I think the new frontier is looking at ways that we can educate clinicians, educate patients, caregivers, and then look for models that support a palliative care approach and outside of what would be, you know, a referral to someone who does palliative medicine.
Could you explain the palliative care approach, one that you're...
So when we approach patient care using the palliative care approach, essentially what it boils down to is addressing all of those needs and issues that contribute to a person's quality of life. So we think about things like symptom management, neuropsychiatric symptoms, caregiver support and caregiver burden, of course, right up your alley.
Right.
Advanced care planning, so having good discussions early in a disease course, with a caregiver or family member or loved one, planning for the future, coming up with solutions and strategies, and essentially voicing your values, goals as a patient for your physician to understand, knowing that in the future they may have to rely on those past conversations to make decisions in situations like with Alzheimer's, where, you know, as the disease progresses, someone might not be able to have a meaningful discussion about treatment and management. And so a palliative care approach is certainly something that, you know, a primary care physician or general neurologist could adapt and take into their practice, just understanding these sort of conversations that look beyond sort of just symptom management and disease treatment, but rather discussing all of the components that play a role in someone's quality of life. Knowing that, especially with a lot of these conditions, we don't necessarily have a treatment or a cure. Certainly, we're looking for those as research progresses. But knowing that in the meantime, we can at least make sure that these patients are able to live their lives to the fullest. And that's really what undertaking a palliative care approach means, essentially. It's just looking at all parts of a person's life and knowing them as a, and then also taking into account that we're looking at them as a person and not just a disease.
Right. So from a health and nutrition standpoint, an emotional standpoint, a spiritual standpoint, everything concerned there.
Absolutely. Yes,
yeah.
Definitely.
And why I think this is important, and I want to hit on a couple of things, and I'm going to try and keep them separate so I can ask you a few variances here. So a few years ago, I guess it's been 2 years now, I was invited by Dr. Kluger to attend a palliative care trainer class. And there were 20 neurologists there, and I was the only non-medical person. And one thing I found interesting about the class was that the neurologist said that their job is very taxing in this field because they feel like they give someone a diagnosis, they go sit in their car and they cry, and then they go home and they tell their family what has happened, and they generally don't see them again for a year or until a caregiver, a family member who's caring for them, a care partner, has some issue that is a symptom that they can't deal with. Generally, that's when they come back or just a yearly, appointment. So why I wanted you on the show today and why I love this is because I want to know how you're continuing down this road. And I've had Breanne Betcher from the research side on the show a couple of times, and Bree has talked about how she is trying to see what she can do to find therapies ahead of someone actually getting the diagnosis and possibly rerouting it at some point. So, I've known Dr. Potter for many, many years. Again, another guest on the show many times. And I know my family's in a research study out of Washington University at St. Louis. So I guess what I'm getting at is, where do you fall in the continuing of changing that trajectory where maybe appointments are a little bit longer instead of just somebody coming in for 15, 20 minutes? Maybe you sit and talk to them a little bit longer or, you know, can we drill down a little bit on how this is going to be a game changer? Because I feel like it's going to be a game changer.
Yeah. And you've alluded to really the core problem with being able to integrate this sort of approach into, you know, the practice of a, like, general neurologist, for example, is that, you know, there's not a whole lot of time that a neurologist or a PCP or, you know, some other non-palliative care specialist has to sit and talk about these sorts of issues with patients. And really, a lot of the time, a lot of these visits, at least in community-based practices, I myself have the luxury of having a lot of time to talk with patients just based on the clinic I'm in, but a lot of times, you know, these physicians and medical providers are having to focus on specific issues and really not touching on any of the external issues or other parts of a person's life that are certainly playing a role in their disease and certainly could be barriers to taking care of them. And so I think as far as the trajectory is concerned, and part of where my research lies is looking for ways to prepare a patient and their loved one or caregiver for going into their visit with a neurologist and looking at, well, what's the role of a neurologist in having discussions surrounding things like advanced care planning or other palliative care sort of themes? Mm-hmm. Because if we prepare patients and caregivers kind of cuts out a lot of time and where you have to sort of broach the topic, explore it, and then go into more depth, and allows you to sort of prime patients for immediately jumping into really the depth of a good quality discussion.
Mm-hmm.
I will say, you know, one thing, and this has been Dr. Kluger's work now for a few years, is looking at a model that allows a patient to have access to a palliative care team, not necessarily seeing them in a clinic, but at least having access to all of the disciplines that could fall under a palliative care. So thinking, you've already mentioned about chaplain, nursing support, social workers, all of these players play an essential role in being able to supplement what a physician alone can't necessarily do on their own.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really where we're moving in terms of looking for ways to get palliative care into standard care for these folks. Because the way the system is built right now, with you know the lack of time that a lot of doctors have to sit down and talk, I think you know there has to be a way to supplement it by using all of the other team members that we have at our disposal, and so or tapping into you know a specialized palliative care resource sort of acts as almost like a hub and spoke. So where there's like a central group, palliative care group, and they're branching out to community-based providers and giving them that extra support. That's one sort of way that this is possibly going to play out. Again, who knows how our healthcare system will change and evolve as time goes by. I hope that it will continue to improve and become more person and patient-centered. But at least for the time being, having to rely on all of our resources, preparing the patients and their loved ones for visits, giving physicians ahead of time, you know, summaries of what to discuss, things that we can do to sort of curb the problem that we're running into, which is we don't really have a whole lot of time to address these issues.
Right. You know, we had kind of given each other some notes before you came on today, and one of the things that you had mentioned you wanted to talk about was advanced care planning for patients with dementia and how we can mm-hmm. improve it. One of the things that I have been trying to do is I try to have a conversation with people in the early stages and really try to focus on keeping the conversation and the information flowing between uh-huh. the person with the diagnosis and the caregiver. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Because sometimes we're afraid of hurting the person's feelings that has a diagnosis. So we talk mm-hmm. around them instead of to them. And so in the classes that I provide, what I talk to them about is, you know, like what financial changes could happen, emotional stress that they might have, legal issues that they might need to take care of, you know, so that they are set in stone years before you actually need it, you know. Which,
yeah.
Just all the things that I've talked to my listeners about for years and years, POAs and what they mean and things like that. One of the things that I've integrated with the docs that we've talked about, and especially with Samantha and Christina Vaughn, is I provide in-home assessments. And so I've been – when I do the in-home assessments, I write a report – and then I give it to the family, and if they will allow me, I will give it to the doctor. Well, a lot of my clients come from UCH, from this team. And so I give that information back, and it's been very eye-opening because I can give the doctors a view into the home.
Absolutely, yeah.
Which they rarely see. And that's one of the ways that I have been trying to contribute and improve, you know, how the neurologist can really see what's going on in a home and maybe mm-hmm. just change their thought process a little bit. Because typically families will come in and they'll say, he's doing this or she's doing that. And they say, no, I'm not. I'm not doing anything. No.
Yeah.
So being able to have those really good conversations, you know, you have taken on a vast program here, but I really think it's much needed, and I'm pretty excited about that. So do you have anything you want to add about the patients? Because then I want to move to how you're going to support the caregivers.
Yeah, I think, you know, you've actually touched on a really interesting sort of thing that we've run into as we're doing more telemedicine in the age of COVID and everything, as we kind of move towards telehealth as being the way that we're seeing patients and such, in that, you know, getting a picture of what their actual home looks like, what is their living situation, their environment look like. I think that's something that, for patients, you know, as someone who takes care of patients, being able to actually see them in their home environment for me has been a very unique situation. Knowing, you know, before, just like you mentioned, I'm just hearing it from a care, like in the clinic, from a patient and their loved one. And a lot of times there's a lot of discrepancy between what they're saying and what the caregiver is reporting. But yeah, I think that is an excellent way to approach this, looking at, you know, a way to actually sort of get a really good illustration for how someone is actually functioning at their home and in their home environment. And so, yeah, I think that's an excellent resource for myself as a neurologist to have, because it really does affect the way I manage patients. If I'm encountering behavioral issues or safety issues at the home, I want to know about those things so that we can intervene early. And so you don't always get a clear picture of that when you're just hearing it in a clinic setting. I think that's an exceptional resource.
It makes a huge difference, because I can go in and say, you need to remove these throw rugs, or you need to remove this or that, or these are the things you can do to make it more safe. But the biggest thing is sitting at a table with both the person with the diagnosis and their care partner and talking to both of them in a straight conversation. What do you need? What do you need? And I love that UCH has been really at the forefront of trying to change the way that we work with families. And I, like I said, I feel really proud to be a part of that and to be able to work with the docs when I'm not medical. I'm non-medical.
Yeah.
But I've been working with people with this disease for 25 plus years. And my family, I haven't told you, but I have a sister who has early stage younger onset. She's 63, Alzheimer's. And even I feel like the way that I work with her and keep lines of communication open is helping us to make her life much better. I told her we ought to do a day in the life on YouTube, you know?
That would be interesting, yeah.
From the caregiver support side, this is more difficult, because now you're in a place where you're dealing with something that they don't even recognize a lot, which is grief, right from the beginning.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Caregivers don't realize that. They feel emotionally stressed. They don't want to feel taxed, because that makes their person with the diagnosis feel like, oh my gosh, am I being a burden? So how do you look at the caregiver support of this?
Yeah, I think number one on my list is of things that I look at when I'm approaching a caregiver who is taking care of somebody, especially if they're having a lot of behavioral issues or the patient's having a lot of neuropsychiatric issues, which, you know, research has shown translates to more caregiver strain, caregiver burden. But I would say the number one thing that I think we as neurologists and really medical providers, or anyone who's taking care of somebody who's experiencing one of these conditions and is supporting their caregiver, but the number one thing is to have an open line of communication. I think, you know, one of the biggest, not problems I would say, but one of the biggest barriers to understanding how things are going in the home is that the caregiver feels like at times that they don't want to, you know, make their loved one feel bad, or they don't want to give out information that they think might harm the way we view their loved one. And so having a good open line of communication for them to be open and honest about the experience they're having, both taking care of the patient, but then also their own personal well-being, is essential. Because when caregivers experience more burden and strain and decline in their own quality of life, we actually see that reflected in the patient's well-being and quality of life. So it makes sense that we would try to address any caregiver issues, caregiver stress, caregiver depression, because that's going to ultimately help us take care of the patient better. So I think having a good open line of communication is number one. Mm-hmm. And then especially if you're somebody who is like a neurologist or other medical provider or someone else who's working with these groups of people, if you're seeing them early on, giving them a clear understanding of possible things that could go on in the future. I think one of the biggest problems I run into, in addition to not having a good open line of communication is when sort of unforeseen circumstances arise that maybe we could have discussed much sooner to prepare the caregiver for that and sort of have contingency plans in place to address issues. I think of confusion and disorientation and delusional behaviors and all of those sorts of things that are incredibly distressful for a caregiver are things that we should make sure they're aware of. So I think having an open line of communication, preparing them, and then also putting a good foundation of support in place sooner rather than later. So getting them in classes like what you offer with resiliency, support groups, so they can connect with others who are having very similar experiences. Mm-hmm. And in that way, we sort of prepare them ahead of time before any problems arise. And so I think those are really the three main things I sort of think about when I am trying to support a caregiver is talking with them early and then also having a good plan in place for any problems that might go on in the future, which can be hard to predict. Some of these diseases are, as you know, very unpredictable.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But at least having a discussion of what could happen and what do we do about it.
Right. One of the things that I think is really interesting and I want to share with you from a caregiver standpoint, in my classes, I really do touch on many of the things you just mentioned. But the biggest thing I don't think that the neurologists see is that I put the onus back on the caregiver as well, that a lot of times they will look at a symptom. Maybe someone is having repetitive words or anxiety or something that they like to call sundowners. And I can look at families and say, listen, your emotional stability and the energy you put forth is what you're going to get back. They're going to mirror that energy back to you. And you own that. So one of the things that I try to work with families with is to help them understand that they play a part in the symptoms that they see. If they are anxious, that person might be anxious. If they are sad, that person might be sad. If they don't get enough exercise throughout the day and they're letting them sleep all day so that the caregiver can get things done, you're going to have sundowners more often. So those are interesting things that I find as I'm working with families to try to help them manage the symptoms as well. So, you know, it's just an interesting paradigm, the whole thing, that we're trying so hard to help these families live well with these diseases. And the biggest message I think you and I both want to put out there is it doesn't have to be bad. We're not stamping a deficiency on your forehead when you were proficient in every other place in your life. Yeah. And that there are ways that we can help you to live better with these diseases. And our friends with Parkinson's are the shining stars in this area because they realize that they do have some things that they can do to help themselves. And I want to share that message to these other neurodegenerative, I can talk right today, really. I can't. Neurodegenerative diseases. But at any rate, we're going to take a short break and we're going to come back. And I want you to talk about how you manage the psychiatric symptoms, the neuropsychiatric symptoms amongst patients. We'll be right back.
Living and working with Alzheimer's and other dementias can often be challenging. Summit Resilience Training provides education utilizing non-medical approaches for those who work with our friends affected by dementia. Believing families still need one-on-one assistance, we provide classes which help them understand the diseases affecting their loved ones, offering strategies and techniques for success with activities of daily living and working with confusing behaviors. We offer in-home assessments to clarify symptoms of dementia diseases and help families work together to find moments of joy while living with memory loss and impairment. Education programs instilling person-centered care philosophies are offered for professional caregivers working in communities and homes, which can be customized for their staff. Training is also available for first responders, such as law enforcement, fire, and EMT personnel. We are passionate that people with dementias such as Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and others are approached with compassion and understanding, and those who work with them have all the tools they need for success. Call us at Summit Resilience Training, 303-420-6988, to schedule a class or in-home assessment. Visit our website at summitresiliencetraining.com for more information.
Welcome back to Dementia Resilience with Jill Lorenz.
Okay, we're back. And I have Dr. Zachary Mackey with me from the University of Colorado Hospital Neurological Department. He is working in the research area of the Movements and Memories Disorders Clinic. You didn't actually say you're working in the movements group, but you do work with those folks, right, Zach?
Correct, yeah. Some of my patients do have movement disorders that are affecting their cognition or behaviors, yes.
Okay. So we know that with Lewy body as an example and Parkinson's and whichever comes first in that disease realm of the cousins there, we can have psychosis. Do mm-hmm. you deal with those types of things?
Yes. Unfortunately, this is an issue that I deal with more frequently than I would hope. but yes, many, especially patients with dementia with Lewy bodies, and more so than others. But really, this is a common issue that's experienced kind of across the board amongst a lot of patients with dementia with Lewy bodies, Alzheimer's, frontotemporal dementia, where their disease is affecting the way that they perceive their reality, their world around them, mm-hmm. the way they interact with people. And it is a tough problem to deal with, unfortunately.
It really is. And I have found that a lot of times, especially our friends with Parkinson's disease, when they have a psychosis and they're seeing things that are not truly there, but they believe they are, mm-hmm. I try to work with the caregiver and say, if it's not a problem for them, let it go. Don't make a bigger issue out of it. And generally, when I provide my in-home assessments, if someone is having hallucinations, I can trace them back to something in their life. So mm-hmm. Typically if people see children, they worked with children at some point in time.
Mm-hmm.
Or they had a lot of kids, but generally they worked with kids. I find this more often than not. When people see dogs or cats, they've had them their whole life, so it's not unusual. It's something that is comforting to them in some way. But when they have people in their home that they don't know why they're there, I try to empower them to say, I don't want you here. Please leave. Like talk to that psychosis and tell it what you want it to do. And I have found success with that. But it's not always that easy. Sometimes we see bugs on the wall. Sometimes we think or we see fire or smell smoke. So how do you help both the person with the diagnosis and the caregiver when they're extreme? What's going to be your path to trying to help them with that?
Yeah, and you've already touched on really the first line sort of approach to this is looking at a non-pharmacologic way to treat it. So not jumping to a medication, which certainly has its own risks. But a lot of times people come to me and say, you know, I think they need a medication because they're delusional or they're having visual hallucinations. But I think, getting a good idea of, number one, how disturbing and how much these are affecting the quality of life of patients and then the caregiver's perceptions of that. And then looking back to sort of the source of where these are coming from. It's interesting that you point out that a lot of times the manifestation of hallucinations is a reference to something in their past life. And that's not something I had actually appreciated, but something I'll certainly be more aware of as I talk with patients. But especially empowering them to understand that not just the patient, but also the caregiver, that if they're not causing a lot of disruption or disturbances in someone's life, it's all right to just let them be, acknowledge mm-hmm. them, and sort of live with them.
Mm-hmm.
And then also looking at ways that you can modify someone's home or their environment to sort of curb any disruptions that it's creating or sort of alleviate any distress that it's causing. So in that way, I like to look at what are some strategies, what are some things that we can do to ensure that somebody is going to be safe and that it's not distressing to them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think education is pivotal to this. So understanding that this is a manifestation of their disease and that there are ways that we can try to improve or alleviate these experiences without having to jump to a medication. Having said that, there are some circumstances where a medication is required. If somebody is somebody is creating an unsafe environment for themselves or their loved one, if it's causing significant caregiver distress and it's affecting the way a caregiver is able to take care of their loved one, mm-hmm. those are circumstances where I think discussing the risks and benefits of a medication that could improve mood or cognition should be considered. Thankfully, at least in the world of Alzheimer's, for sure, there has been research that's been done that's looked at a lot of the medications that we used for boosting cognition and improving memory and somewhat slowing progression. And those medications can be useful for having a twofold effect on behaviors and psychosis and delusions. So there are some ways that we can sort of kill two birds with one stone, so to speak, mm-hmm. And use something for one purpose and then getting an added benefit of improving psychotic symptoms. And then in extreme situations, sometimes we do have to look for other ways to keep a person safe, especially if it's causing an unsafe environment for family members, especially thinking of somebody with early onset who might have young children still in the house or behaviors that are unsafe towards them. Mm-hmm. Then I think it's sort of the extreme at which we start talking about other levels of support or other sort of living situations to make sure that the patient is well taken care of, but then also make sure the family and the caregiver are supported and safe as well. So that's sort of illustrated from a broad spectrum of what that looks like.
Right. And I couldn't agree more because, you know, on the show, I have told listeners many times that I'm not really in favor of medicating someone just to medicate them. But there are times, especially when a person maybe with Lewy body, as an example, and to the degree you were talking about the medications, I find it really fascinating that Aricept seems to work on people with Lewy body in the later stages.
Yes, yeah, and that's what I was alluding to earlier.
Right,
that's one that we use commonly for, you know, the dementia, the cognitive impairment, but it also has some other benefits too.
Right. Well, I certainly think that these are tough situations, but families just don't realize that they have a big role in how these diseases play out to a degree. And the more they can learn, like you said, educate, 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 the more they can learn about it, the more they can understand it. And I just wanted to touch on one of the other things that you mentioned. So delusions with a person with Alzheimer's, the biggest thing that I tell families is don't take it personally. It's the disease.
Uh-huh.
You stole my purse.
Yes.
Or something else. So when the family member can understand that different parts of the brain control that person's personality or them recognizing an object or being able to name that object or being able to sequence any task, you know, from A to Z, mm-hmm. and get through it and where that deterioration takes place, family members have a tendency to be more understanding and compassionate when they know how to deal with those things. But I'm glad that you're taking an approach on the neuropsychiatric symptoms because it is the biggest issues that I think I hear about more so than bathing and someone
absolutely
just being obstinate,
yeah,
about something or, you know.
And I will say, too, you know, this is something that if you look to the community, so thinking about primary care physicians, this is like the number one issue. They feel they have a lack of training or they just don't know how to approach these situations. And so that's where, you know, kind of going to your friendly neighborhood neurologist or behavioral neurologist might be appropriate, because this is a major issue that is very difficult for someone, even for myself as a behavioral neurologist, to manage, let alone somebody who that's not necessarily what they do as their primary practice. So.
Right. And so that's a perfect segue into the next thing I wanted to ask you about. When I have classes and I'm explaining the dementia umbrella, okay, the diseases under the dementia umbrella. And people are often surprised because they think dementia and Alzheimer's are the same thing. One is just a worsening of the other. You know, we always have to educate them on this. And,
sure.
and that there's Parkinson's, there's Huntington's disease, there's ALS. It just goes down the line, right? And so
yes.
The question I inevitably get in my beginner class is, why does the doctor say you have dementia and they
right.
leave it alone? It's like saying you have cancer and never telling them what type. And I
right.
try to stress that even though there is no cure for any of the dementia diseases to date, we learn more when we can say, all right, go down this lane, this is frontal temporal. Go down this lane, this is Lewy body. Go down this lane, it's
yes.
Parkinson's disease. This is Alzheimer's. And when we can line those out, now my answer to them is if they're going to their general practitioner, generally they are not someone who has per se studied the brain. They became
right.
a doctor and they went through all their many, many years and of school and residency and everything else. But that didn't necessarily mean they picked a specialty. But yet we go to our general practitioner. So what are the ways that we can connect these folks, you know, from their primary care providers then to neurology specialists? Because oftentimes
yeah.
these folks don't know that they can even do that. They don't know to ask for a specialist, or they get
mm-hmm.
a diagnosis, and I'm sorry this is a long thing, but they get a diagnosis of MCI, and then they say, well, my husband had MCI 5 years ago, and we just haven't been back to the doctor,
yeah.
so he just has MCI, and they don't realize that it may or may not get worse over time. And by the time they're
mm-hmm.
in my class, they're smack dab in the middle of early stage, you know, but
right.
they don't know
yep.
it. So what are some of the ways that we can connect primary care providers with neurology specialists? How do we bridge that gap?
Yeah, and I think, you know, it goes back to training and education, especially the way we're training primary care physicians, whether they're family medicine, internal medicine, because it is important to understand, you know, what disease is causing a dementia just being the syndrome, not the disease itself, because it certainly has implications for the trajectory, understanding sort of prognosis and what to expect and supporting the caregiver. But I think, yeah, this really is sort of falls on me as a specialist, because this current system that we have right now, unfortunately, and I think this is, you know, sort of a cliche and sort of a cop-out, if you will, but it's really the system is not set up in a way to get a primary care physician readily access to a neurologist, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, at least in its current state, it's sort of the burden falls on folks like me and folks who I work with in the memory disorders clinic and neurologists in general to think about ways to educate our colleagues out in the community and sort of have that outreach, sort of building awareness for the fact that, hey, we are available to answer any questions as consultants, but then also to stress the idea that it is important to have an understanding of what the probable diagnosis is, knowing that a lot of these conditions are not necessarily diagnosed with a blood test or a foolproof way in the current state of things. But I think it really falls on us as neurologists and as educators, especially in academics like ACU, to reach out to the community and make sure people are aware of the importance of getting a most accurate diagnosis, as well as making them aware that we're here to support them. And that can come through folks like me in the behavioral section, memory disorders clinic, and then also our neuropalliative clinic, which we do have at CU. And they, because we're all integrated and work in the same environment, we are able to talk to each other and communicate. So, again, going back to communication, which is a common thread throughout everything we've really discussed, is
mm-hmm.
Communication amongst clinicians, not just communication with patients and specialists and caregivers, but also amongst ourselves as people taking care of these folks.
You know, and I think the university hospital has done a great job. In every year, they have been hosting, you know, a Saturday 4-hour, you know, come and learn kind of thing. So I know Dr. Holden has held you know, a conference on Lewy bodies. And her and Dr. Potter get together and put out information about Alzheimer's. I'm working with Peter Pressman right now on getting information out about frontal temporal and some new research that he has going on. But people just don't know these things are available. So that's why I'm grateful. And what you don't know is I have listeners in all 50 states and 54 countries. So this is going out to a lot of people. And, you know, it's good that across the country, we're getting these little pods of these dementia research, you know, places. We didn't even have this in Denver until 2012. So, there wasn't anything within a 5-state region, and now we are, you know, it's there for a 5-state region. And then going, you know, we've got San Francisco, we've got St. Louis, and we need all these doctors talking to each other so that we can, so we can really build, you know, a strong foundation for people to be able to go out and research this knowledge. And that's why I'm so appreciative that we have the research center there and the clinical side as well, so that these folks can go and get the help they need on something that is meaningful to them. So they're not just thinking, oh, it's just dementia. If it's Parkinson's disease, they can learn about the different variations of Parkinson's disease and Lewy body or, you know, whatever it is. So I just find this crazy impactful. The COVID-19 has not been helpful. I was having my classes out at the hospital. I was teaching them in the Stapleton area, you know, at the clinic there, and then also at the hospital. And then we had to go to Zoom classes, which has not been great, but hey, it works. And and telemedicine was going that way anyway. How has that impacted or affected you?
Yeah, so I mentioned earlier, I now moved purely to telehealth as a means for evaluating and taking care of patients and supporting caregivers. And it certainly has been, you know, there's been growing pains with adjusting to it. And it's no absolute substitute for in-person visits, I'll say. While it's awesome for getting somebody access to me who is driving from hours and hours away or has problems with mobility, where it's difficult to actually come into a clinic. You know, there are certainly parts where telemedicine and telehealth are excellent in that regard, but it's not necessarily a surrogate or a way to supplant the lost in-person experience. And there's something to be said about, you know, just actually being physically with someone, laying hands on them as you examine them. There's this therapeutic sort of benefit that patients get from just going in and seeing their doctor. And so, you know, I think we're really losing that part of the therapeutic relationship as physicians with our patients. And this is certainly not limited to just what I do or neurologists, but kind of across the board. And, you know, I've heard this from patients and caregivers where they say telehealth is not the same. It's good in some ways, but it's just not the same. And I feel like I'm missing out on or losing something. So there's a sense of loss that I've been noticing amongst patients and caregivers. Part of my work with Benzie has been to actually look into this question about how COVID has impacted patients too. And so those are some of the things that we've been noticing.
You know, it's a big deal, but for me, it's actually been a bit of a plus. And one of the reasons is because I tell my listeners that I have these classes and I lead them to my website and let them know they can sign up there. And I'm literally getting people from Australia, New Zealand, who are saying it's 2:00 in the morning here, you know, but all over the world, which I never would have had. Doing them in the classrooms, which when we go back in the classroom, I'm still going to keep it on Zoom so that people from other countries can still focus in on it.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I think, you know, what's been really a really cool opportunity to observe and learn about the role of telemedicine, you know, outside of COVID is how do we strike that balance between taking the greater positive qualities of telemedicine and integrating it into what we're already doing. Because I agree with you. There have definitely been incredible positives to come out of rapidly adopting teleconferencing and telemedicine. And so I think learning about ways that we can strike that balance and sort of taking this opportunity and looking at the silver lining to learn about how we integrate this into what we do is an exceptional opportunity.
Right. Well, it's amazing that the group out there keeps growing. I'm so pleased that you have joined them. This is fantastic. And I remember when Dr. Potter was the only doctor in the research center. Now he has 16 people working with him. And I remember when Breanne Betcher came out from San Francisco, you know, and just watching this team grow and grow. And Peter Pressman came from San Francisco. And now you've come from Kansas. And it's growing and growing. And that gives me hope. And especially that we have more young people interested in this field because, you know, we need more scientists. We need more people that want to work on the research side. I myself, like I said, my family is in a familial study out of WashU at St. Louis. And so I just find this to be so impactful. I tell my listeners all the time, I want to be part of the cure, not part of the problem. So I'm absolutely thrilled that you have joined the team. Are there any other things that you have on the horizon that you want to share with us that you're working on or something we didn't touch on?
Yeah, I think we touched on really the big pieces I was hoping to discuss. I think, you know, I'm really excited for, like you mentioned, the progress we've made so far, being able to be a part of this movement that we're seeing in Colorado. And looking at, you know, where this will go in the future, I think, you know, we're going to start to see more exponential growth sort of in the clinical side and research side of things in our own area, as well as nationwide, as the demand becomes greater and greater, I think. And so, yeah, I would just echo what you said is being very excited for the future and being able to provide care for patients and caregivers and help support my colleagues as well.
Well, I am excited to say to you, if you can utilize my help in any way, let me know. Because what I love
to do is
work with the families and work with the people with diagnosis and bring everyone together. And with that, I want to let the listeners know that the next In the Trenches class, we call it the Continuum class, it is going to be about having a peaceful holiday with your loved ones, with COVID, you know, without it, how to work within the realm of changing your traditions to make sure it fits the scenario of what you're trying to do now. As a quick example, if you're used to having a lot of people at your house, now you may have to have an open house throughout the day, or you may need to go to someone else's house. With COVID, you may have a much quieter holiday. And there could be some disappointments with that because you're used to having family come, kinds of gifts that you can buy for people with a diagnosis and people that are their care partners and so on and so forth. So I'll get deep into the trenches, and that is December 2nd. It is 1:30 to 3:30 Mountain Time. I do it the first Wednesday of the month, no matter what. I keep it very regulated. So it's the first Wednesday of the month from 1:30 to 3:30 Mountain Time. You can register for that class, my friends, by going on my website under events. My website is Summit Resilience Training, and I have a lot of knowledge on my website for you, especially in my Knowledge Center. Click on that tab, and I have 45 pieces of information about a lot of information you need to know about, avoiding scams during the holidays and things of that nature. So, all right. Well, Zach, it's been great having you on the show.
Yeah, been great talking with you. Thank you very much for having me.
I hope that I'll get you back sometime, and I want to have a benchmark of today, and then maybe we talk again in a few months or 6 months and see how far you've come and what you're working on, and if you'd come back and share it with my listeners, I'd appreciate it.
That would be great. I'd be honored. Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you. And listeners, have a wonderful Thanksgiving, and we will see you next week on Dementia Resilience with Jill Lorenz.
You've been listening to Dementia Resilience with Jill Lorenz. To learn more about her resources, services, classes, or to book speaking engagements, visit Jill's website at summitresiliencetraining.com. A new podcast drops every Tuesday, so join us as we learn more about dementias, resilience, and overcoming obstacles to find a positive outcome. Dementia Resilience with Jill Lorenz can be found on your favorite podcast provider. Please subscribe and give us a 5-star rating. Musical and technical support provided by Brian Hunter. See you next week.